Politics Matters with Eleanor Penny, general election coverage on FUBAR Radio.
But I do think that Brexit is the biggest foreign policy blunder of the post-war period.
Well, you said can you allow me to finish? Well, do you mind?
Yeah, but I asked you a question and you're ignoring it.
No, I'm not ignoring the question. If you'd give me a minute, I'll answer it.
You come under a lot of pressure then to support Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister because he will be promising a so-called people's
Let me
vote,
be incredibly clear about this. Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, I do not believe are fit to be Prime Minister.
Body language throughout this evening has been so contemptuous of this House
and for the benefit of Hansard, the leader of the House has been spread
across around three seats, lying out.
If you ask me why am I relatable, I don't, you know, why am I relatable? I've not the faintest idea. It seems to me the most difficult psychological question that anybody's ever asked me.
Good afternoon and welcome to the very first episode of Politics Matters, a brand spanking new election coverage show here on FUBAR Radio. We're bringing you 4 weeks of news and views to sort facts from fiction and sweep away the Westminster gossip to get to the heart of what's really at stake here as we face our third election in under 5 years. I'm Eleanor Penny, your host and glamorous assistant on this journey through the political wilderness. You can follow me on Twitter at Eleanor K. Penny, and you can have your say on at FUBAR Radio on every social media platform around, and you can email us politicsmatters@fubarradio.com, and you can register to vote in under 10 minutes, so get it done. This week we'll be talking about climate change, radical economics and the so-called Remain Alliance with some amazing guests. With me in the studio is writer and academic Dahlia Gabriel, and we will be joined later by economist James Medway and Alfie Sterling and Green candidate for Stroud Molly Scott Cato. All that and more coming your way. So Dahlia, hello. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, hi.
It's that time of year again. Election season. Politicians careening around the country to hold babies and bore school children and look pretty weird in high vis and hard hats and fondle horticultural produce. But it really does seem like something's different here. The gulf between our main two political parties has never been wider, and the decision has been never more stark. And it feels like for the first time in my life, certainly, some of our politicians are finally getting it hammered into their heads that the end of history that they promised in the 1980s is well and truly over, and politics might be, shocker, more than just politely managing the free market for better or for worse. Everything, as one Twitter user so wonderfully put it, is brutally, horribly possible. Which of course means that everything is wonderfully, stupendously, giddyingly possible. It's politics, Jim, but not as we know it. So Dahlia, how would you characterise the choice that's in front of us? Boris v Corbyn, smackdown for the number 10 crown.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're completely right in that all throughout my lifetime, particularly through since I was able to vote, there's always been this sense that what's really the difference? What's the point in voting? It's the same thing. It's the same thing. And that has been true up until this particular election. So what we have is we have basically two crises that mean that this election is different to any other election that anyone under 25 or 30 will have sort of lived through. So the first one is climate crisis, which we're going to talk about later. But the second one, I think, is the 2008 financial crisis. Now, that wasn't the first time that we had like a massive economic crisis. But I think what we're seeing now and with the sort of polarization of politics is really a consequence of the fact that in 2008, the kind of common sense politics of like trickle down economics, you know, a small number of people are going to make loads and loads of money, and then we're just going to wait and wait for it to like piss down on us, kind of got completely delegitimized because suddenly we saw this kind of like speculative gambling based economy completely fail, and then the people had to bail that crisis out. So that's why we're seeing this kind of polarization on in terms of, you know, the kind of Boris Johnson, Trump-esque politics, the Farageite politics, and the kind of politics of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. It's saying there are two ways now. The previous system has been delegitimized. The two ways now are to go into kind of like further nationalism, putting up borders, selling off more of our public services to the private market.
Sort of doubling down.
Doubling down, concentrating all of those resources into the hands of the few. And then the other option is to kind of completely rewire that economy, invest in public infrastructure, invest in social services, open borders, keeping free movement, and tackling the climate crisis through a kind of like systemic redistribution of wealth and resources.
So how do we make sense of third parties like the Lib Dems in this picture? Because what they seem to be doing is posing themselves as the adults in the room, right? The people who will cop neither to the what they pose as like two equivalent extremes, kind of equating between a massive investment in infrastructure and a reinvigorated ethno-nationalist horror show on the other, which, you know, if that's your tipple, you know, fair play to
then
you, but I think
out.
That's completely, tune out now, log off permanently. But, you know, why are the Lib Dems clinging to this? Like, do you think it has any legs?
Yeah, I think they're just living in a fantasy world. And I think the whole kind of like Westminster bubble, and the perfect example of this was when a couple of Labour Party MPs basically fucked off to form the Independent Group for Change. And a couple of Tories joined them as well. And that idea was to kind of be like, we're going to try and recover that old school politics, that kind of politics of Tony Blair, of David Cameron, etc. And there was like so much buzz in the media, and there was so much buzz in Westminster. There was a sense that this was going to, you know, sink the Tory and the Labour Party, and it came up to absolutely nothing. So, you know, they still haven't released a manifesto. They still kind of like are very much sort of flailing. They have no kind of clout with the general public. And I think that kind of gap between what's happening on the ground and what Westminster journalists are reporting comes from the fact that they are still living in that fantasy world. They haven't really caught up to the fact that the political map is being completely redrawn. People's priorities are completely changing, and that basically the old system has been really delegitimized.
And I think either of the two kind of, you know, polar options we've been talking about, you know, Tories versus the left of the Labour Party, we'll still have to grapple with that political reality, because going around talking to people on the doorstep, irrespective of their age, irrespective of their background, a lot of the times there is this sense that kind of, despite it being a deeply political moment and people being hungry for political change, there seems like people have been hammered into disillusionment with this particular mode of doing politics, aka the kind of politics that happens in SW1 in the whispering corridors of power by people who went to Eton and wear fur collars on taxpayer expense. And, you know, you've got to hand it to them, that's pretty accurate. And both the Conservatives and Labour are going to have to do a lot of work to sort of break through that sense of inertia, despite the fact that we are seeing a lot of political engagement, particularly from young people.
Yeah.
And talking of, let's go and have a look at what the polls are saying. Now, disclaimer, polling is not an exact science, and a lot of the polls that we are seeing being rolled out are anticipating a completely minute turnout amongst voters aged between 18 and 35. Now, that doesn't track on to the huge numbers of 18 to 35-year-olds that we've already seen registering to vote, but a third of us are still not registered. So, let me find my air horn. Brace yourselves. Register to vote, goddammit. Are you going to leave the economy up to Etonites who literally burn £50 notes in front of homeless people? Are you silly? Don't mug yourself up. Don't mug yourself off. Register to vote. Do it now. Thank you. Yes, God. Let's look at the polls. So, poor Joe Swinson. Poor Jo Swinson, who has had to go on national media to deny that she kills squirrels for fun. This is the
poor irrelevant Jo.
Poor irrelevant Jo. Basically, the more people see of the Lib Dems, the less they like of them, and the people who were kind of screwed over by them in the 2010 coalition, and they've kind of doubled down on those alliances now, which we'll talk about later, are kind of coming to an age of sort of political activism, political engagement, etc. And we're kind of seeing the fruition of that, not just among their own base, but among Remain voters who they're obviously courting. So Conservatives at 39.7%. That's a rise of 2.6%. This is the latest poll out of Britain Elects. Labour is also up to 28.8%. That's the, that gap between them is squeezing somewhat. The Lib Dems are on 15.8%. That's a drop of 0.2%. The Brexit Party are down to 7%. That's a drop of 2%. And the Lib Greens are hanging on around 2.8%. That's a squeeze of 0.2%. Now, that's a lot of numbers I've just thrown at you. But the main takeaway is that smaller parties are stagnating and getting squeezed. And this is looking increasingly like a two-horse race between Johnson on one hand and Corbyn on the other. Now, that belies some broader trends that we need to talk about. YouGov and the Institute for Public Policy Research have brought out some studies that say just 2% of people want to keep the economy as it is, and over 60% favour moderate to radical change, and actually 66% favour the redistribution of enterprises and corporations' wealth to its workers. Now, that's a pretty kind of radical agenda that could cleave to a really sort of stonkingly huge mandate for a left-wing government. But that doesn't seem to be borne out in the polls. So, Dahlia, what do you make of that?
So what's really crucial here is that a lot of these polls rely on predicting that the youth turnout will be incredibly low. And what I would say is that we should look at who wants young people to vote and who doesn't want young people to vote. And here, that's where the clue as to who you should vote for lies. So Boris Johnson tried to introduce a sort of very racist piece of legislation to basically say that you need to have ID to vote. Now, this is something that exists in the US, and it's a very sort of like well-rehearsed tactic of voter suppression. What it does is it means that people who are less likely to have passports or less likely to have a kind of long-term permanent residence are unable, will not be able to vote. Now, that means that millions of people, in the majority of whom will be young people, working class people and people of colour, would not have been able to vote in this election. Now, luckily, that was palmed off. But that, you know, it didn't pass. But that tells you that Boris Johnson is desperate for you to not vote because he knows that his policies will not bear sort of anything good for young people. And I have to be very clear that five more years of the Conservative Party will affect young people the most because it will look like a drastic reduction of opportunities. It will look like a starving of the welfare state, including the NHS. And it will basically look like shafting the young in order to maintain a system that keeps very, very a very small number of people very rich and the rest of us kind of struggling for the scraps that fall from beneath the table.
So what a Conservative PR man might put to you is that the Conservatives are promising a £400 million boost in education for 16 to 19 year olds, seven billion pounds more a year for schools, nearly £4 billion more for the NHS. This looks like austerity's over, right? This looks like there's this huge kind of wealth of new funding that's being kind of drafted in order to save the economy and do all those things that you've been talking about.
But firstly, these kinds of numbers are actually not enough to compensate for the damage that austerity has done to our country. And secondly, it makes no sense that you are the ones that have caused this crisis. You know, it doesn't take a genius when they introduce these kind of cuts. They knew, it doesn't take a genius to know that if you cut education, if you cut healthcare, working class and young people will be disproportionately affected. They went ahead and did it anyway. They knew exactly what would happen. It wasn't economically necessary. As many economists pointed out, austerity is not the answer to a recession. But they went ahead anyway. These are ideological cuts. And so it makes no... So it's obviously a kind of tactic to try and win back voters on false premises, to gut the welfare state of its resources. And then to kind of, when you need people's votes, to sort of say, okay, we'll throw out this number, this number, this number. But we don't have any reason to believe a single word that comes out of the mouth of Boris Johnson. This man had two op-eds ready to go before he announced that he was going to endorse Leave, because he was still weighing up which position, Leave or Remain, would be best for his career. It is like, I wouldn't trust him to, like, walk my dog. Like, it's just, we have no reason to believe what he has to say. And the Conservative Party are ideologically mandated to serve the few, the rich few, at the expense of the many.
I think it's useful here to refer back to that old adage of, you know, if you want to assess the character of a man, look at who his friends are. Let me just play you a clip. This is notorious scam artist and fascist Tommy Robinson. Oh, doesn't seem to be playing. Our delightful producer Abby just running in. But whilst we get that sorted, Britain has 151 billionaires, which is a mind-boggling amount of money. But moreover, one in three of those, 48 billionaires, have personally donated to the Conservative Party. And that really should tell you everything that you need to know about the Conservative manifesto, right? And I don't deny that voting Labour, voting for any political party, is a gamble. It's an act of faith, really. Mm. But when you look at, like, the promises that have been made by the Conservative Party, we know what they're going to do. We know they're going to sell the NHS off for parts. We know that they're going to scrap the last of the social welfare net that is, you know, barely holding people together. And
not holding people together.
Well,
that's
precisely, 120,000 people dead. Let me just get that clip up for you.
Everyone should vote for Boris Johnson. I think that I'm so happy with what Nigel Farage's done. Nigel Farage should attack the Labour heartlands. He should attack the Labour heartlands. And if we want Brexit, if we believe in democracy, we have to have Brexit. So, yeah, go Boris.
That was famed conspiracy theorist, scam artist, contemptor of court, and, of course, white nationalist Tommy Robinson throwing all of his weight behind our dear Boris. We're going to come on to talk about Labour's economic policies in more depth later on with Alfie Sterling and James Medway. But we have on the line here Molly Scott-Cato, who is the MEP, who is a Green MEP and a prospective MP candidate for Stroud.
Hello.
Hello, Molly. It's lovely to have you on. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. It's a lovely day.
That's very optimistic of you. It's freezing in here, but I'll have to take that on trust. So, the Green Party has just come out just this morning, committing to a 2030 deadline to tackle the climate crisis. Now, lots of people are calling this the climate election. This is where our last chance, essentially, to meet the kind of massive investment demands that will save us from the worst effects of the climate crisis. It's too late for many people, right? So can you tell me a bit more about what the Green Party is setting its sights on, what it's intending to do to meet this ecological crisis?
Well, that's right. We've got 10 years now to stop runaway climate change, and half of that time will be during the course of the Parliament that we're electing MPs on the 12th of December. So it's really important that we have a lot of Green MPs there, because, as you say, we take the climate very seriously. We've had this 2030 net zero carbon target for a while now, and we also have a plan to get there, and that plan is called the Green New Deal. And so it's a lot of very practical things, like, for example, insulating everybody's homes and making sure that their homes are heated by electricity or heat pumps and not by gas, because obviously we need to get rid of all fossil fuels. Also investing in public transport, so switching money from road building and HS2 to electrifying our railways, building more local railways and making sure we have frequent and cheap bus services. And so, you know, you can see that not only is it a practical plan to make people's lives better because they'll have warmer homes and better public transport, but it also means the creation of lots of jobs while we're tackling the climate crisis.
Well, on the jobs point, so you have on social media previously cast a bit of doubt on the idea of what many people call a just transition, aka bringing workers, bringing working people, bringing vulnerable people along with us on the transition from like our current very carbon intensive economy into a green sustainable economy. And that's a lot of reasons that people give in terms of skepticism, in terms of getting behind a properly radical green agenda. So how are you going to, like, what's your offer to working people to reassure them that their jobs won't just be scrapped?
I absolutely challenge the fact that I don't think it should be a just transition. Our manifesto is about social justice as well as climate justice. Some people have said that about me, but they're completely wrong. They're saying that to discredit me. And I've worked together with trade unions here in the Southwest. I've done a tour of the Green New Deal, basically explaining to people what it means. And we need to have unions and working people on board because we need to have people doing the jobs, and they need to be good quality, strongly unionized jobs. But what I have said is that you can see from what happened with Labour's announcement yesterday, they put out something saying they would be net carbon zero by 2030. As a Corbyn tweet, suddenly withdrawn, and then we hear from the GMB that they don't actually think this is possible.
Just to correct you there, the GMB, which is a union, which is not the Labour Party, said that 2030 isn't possible, and later the Labour Party confirmed that they would be keeping the 2030 target in. So the Labour Party are also committed to a 2030, which brings me on to, of course, in the...
Can I just finish what I was saying there?
Absolutely.
What Labour are saying is they will do their best to get onto a pathway to net zero carbon by 2050. That's a completely different thing from saying we will reach that target, and that's our pledge. And also Labour are focusing on the energy supply. So that's about like how we generate our electricity, and they want to make that nearly all renewables. And that's great. That's a really big step forward for them. But what they're not doing is dealing with transport and the other sectors that also emit carbon dioxide. And you can't have net zero without including everything. So there is a very big distinction in what we're offering at this election.
I mean, many people within the grassroots of the Labour Party would say that, you know, that this is precisely what they've been campaigning for, and the expansion of green public transport promised in the Labour manifesto is very similar to what you're talking about. But what I'm curious about here is, of course, the Lib Dems, with whom you, the Green Party, is in a Remain alliance, are promising 2045 as their target for decarbonisation. That's a death sentence, basically speaking, for a lot of people in the global south. And of course, the Liberal Democrats have continually ruled out working with the Labour Party, who have a manifesto platform that's much more similar to yours on green issues. And of course, as we know, the Conservative Party have given £10 billion in the last 10 years in bailouts and subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. Now, do you see a contradiction there at all?
I think you're quite right that Greens are closer to Labour in terms of policy, but where we don't agree with them is about how power should be shared. So the Unite to Remain alliance is a very specific thing. It's about getting MPs into Parliament to stop Brexit, not have Labour's policy around negotiating a Labour-style Brexit and then putting it to the people and not being clear about remaining. We're very clear about remaining, and so are the Lib Dems.
So would you revoke Article 50?
No, we say that there should be a referendum, but we will go there to campaign to remain. So it's a very distinct.
But the Labour Party have put the referendum on their manifesto. That's their position.
Their position is not that they are definitely supporting Remain. So our party has a position in between the Liberal Democrats. But what I also wanted to say is that Unite to Remain is about PR. It's about the fact that although a million people voted Green in 2015, we only got one MP. It's about the fact that you get a Labour MP with far fewer votes than a Liberal Democrat MP or a Green MP. So everybody that's standing on a Unite to Remain ticket is also for a proportional electoral system so that we can have fair votes and everybody's vote counts.
Are you critical at all of the very suspect, shall we put it, tactics that the Liberal Democrats have been using in order to kind of further the aims of this Remain alliance? They've been criticised very, very heavily for outright lying on some of their election material. And they've similarly been criticised, you know, for instance, you know, by Majid, who's a Green mayor and MEP, for actually jeopardising what they say they're setting out to do by splitting the Remain vote between Labour, the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, and essentially giving it to the Tories, who, as we know, are all in for a hard Brexit.
that's a bit of a complicated lot of things going on there. I would say I haven't seen the specific claims of lying that you're talking about, so I can't talk about those. But I think what's really important to realise here is that Labour is not a Remain party. So the purpose of Unite to Remain is that the parties that are for Remain, Plaid Cymru, Liberal Democrats and Green, are allying in this election because we want to make sure there's enough MPs in the next Parliament actively trying to stop Brexit. That's what I'm standing for. Other Liberal Democrats are standing for that. But that doesn't mean we're in a pact with them or that we agree with them on policies.
So going back to things that around Brexit, would you support extending freedom of movement? I ask because there've been talks and speeches between yourself and people like Rupert Reid, who's an environmentalist, which is wonderful, but who has also criticised things like mass migration on the basis that it's one of the negative aspects of climate change, and saying that we should essentially strengthen anti-migration legislation in response to the climate crisis. How would you respond to someone who supported Remain, supported freedom of movement, but who was a little bit iffy on those kinds of alliances?
So the Green Party's champion freedom of movement, and we celebrate the richness and diversity brought to us by citizens from other European countries who live in our community. And it's really important that we recognise that freedom of movement is a reciprocal right. So when parties say they're going to end freedom of movement, what they mean is they're taking away your opportunity to live and work and form relationships and have families in all the other EU countries. And so we very much want people to keep those rights and to be able to enjoy them just as I've been able to enjoy them.
Should we be extending that to people, so, you know, climate refugees, people who aren't from the European Union, for instance?
So this is what I was going to go on to. Freedom of movement is a thing that's a shared right if you're a member of the EU, and we want to preserve that. Then there's the question of refugees. When I think that the country, Britain, has been absolutely disgraceful in not taking refugees. At the moment, there isn't a category of climate refugees, and I think there should be, and I think Britain, given our historic carbon emissions, should take a particular responsibility for climate refugees.
That's brilliant to hear. I couldn't agree more with you. So I just want to talk to you here about getting more into why you want to stop Brexit. Now, I know that might be a little bit of an obvious question in many ways. You know, I voted Remain myself. I would do it again. But in the in some Green Party material, you've said the single market may be summarised as a massive restructuring of capital around a small number of large corporations and financial institutions subject to EU competition rules. It is not primarily concerned with environmental questions or social issues. Now, what I want to know is, like, in that context, why so committed to the single market?
So the single market is obviously just one aspect of the European Union. And the thing I value most about the European Union as a member of the European Parliament is the commitment to the peace project. It's kept the peace in Europe since the Second World War, and that's something that's really valuable and under threat clearly from Putin and other people that were very keen that Brexit should happen. So that's my number one thing. In terms of the single market, I mean, I do a lot of work as a European parliamentarian battling exactly against that corporate power, so making sure that corporations pay their taxes properly, so that we have high standards on food and on agriculture and so on. But the question is really, in terms of the quote you read me, the question is, what is the best platform from which to fight against the extreme power of corporations in the modern global economy? And my view is we can only do that if we're at the level of the European single market. And Greens and socialists have been really effectively sort of colonising the single market and improving workers' rights and environmental protection for decades now. And so Europe has the highest standards in the world. And although corporations have far too much power and we should constrain them and regulate them much more strongly, we still be better in Europe than anywhere else.
See, this is, I celebrate what you're saying, but this brings me back to, I guess, a nub of confusion that I have in terms of the coherence of the Remain Alliance as a project, right? Because presumably we should be interested not just in stopping Brexit or getting Brexit done as a kind of identitarian issue, but because, you know, these are things that have real impacts on real people's lives, right? I'm sure we can agree on that. But in terms of who one makes alliances with and what they're likely to do in terms of having these material impacts on people's lives. The Liberal Democrats have said that they will scrap business rates. They are committed essentially to indefinite austerity by saying that they will have an indefinite budget surplus. And I'm just kind of curious as to the fact that you don't seem to see any contradiction in the fact that stepping aside for these kinds of projects seems to cut against the very, very praiseworthy things that you say you're supporting and fighting for.
So when I'm sitting there in the European Parliament, I'm trying to get a majority, and very often it is the case that to get the majority, I have to get the Liberals to vote with me. And so I understand exactly the policy areas that we disagree about, whether it's about more pesticides on farms or in actually some of the tax rules, although they've shifted their position on that one a bit. But what I explained, and maybe I'll try this again, is that this is not about a policy negotiation, which is the kind of thing you'd do after the election, where you sit down and you talk through what might be a shared policy platform. It's very much about making sure that we have strong Remain candidates so that we can get all the people that want to vote Remain in a place like Stroud, where I'm standing, to vote for a single candidate. And what we're really concerned about is that what we had in the last Parliament was the Tories, who were trying to make Brexit happen in one way, Labour, who were willing for Brexit to happen in another way, and very few MPs who were actually just trying to stop Brexit. So Unite to Remain is basically an alliance to make sure that the smaller parties are better represented in Parliament, more fairly represented, because lots of people actually want to vote for us, but they're not. It's not easy for them to elect MPs because of this two-party first-past-the-post system. So it's partly to work against that and partly to make sure that we get lots of MPs in the next Parliament who actively want to stop Brexit, and that's exactly why I want to be there.
So one last question. So what would you say to people who are saying that you're actually splitting the Remain vote by not including the Labour Party in your calculations? Because the Remain Remain Alliance is standing against Labour MPs who have come out and said that they very strongly support Remain. So say what you want about the position of the Labour Party more generally, but these specific MPs have said that they will throw their full weight behind these projects.
So in 2017, we organised what we called a Progressive Alliance. We tried to get Labour to talk with us about that. We stood aside in lots of speeches for Labour, but all they did with the power we helped them achieve was really progress Brexit and not oppose it. So this time we've tried to talk with them again because we would have liked them to be part of the Remain Alliance, but the problem is they don't have a clear Remain policy, and also they won't ever talk about standing aside in seats. So there was really no way we could include them, and that's a shame.
Molly, thank you so much for talking to us. I hope you have a fantastic day.
Thank you.
So, next up on the show, we will be talking to Alfie Sterling and James Medway, who are both economists who will help us unpack what's really going on in the economy, what's at stake, and how the different parties are setting out to solve it. Thank you so much to my guest, Dahlia Gabriel. You have been absolutely fantastic.
Thank you for having me.
I'll see you in just a second.
See you soon.
FUBAR Radio presents
Ian Molesworth,
joined now by Kadeem Ramsey. So we're talking about Top Boy, which Nat's a bit obsessed with, and you come in with branded Top Boy gear. Are you contractually obliged to do that?
No, I just like it.
You wear it well.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah,
I just feel like wearing it.
Nice
today.
Hoodie.
The only show I watch currently is Top Boy. I've been watching Top Boy over and over.
I love that you watch your own show. That's really great.
No, that's not only it. I've been watching.
Are you going for your Top Boy tattoo after you've done this interview? Right across your forehead.
I'm scared.
Are you really?
Yeah,
are you?
I don't want to be getting a tattoo and the guy says, whoops. Yeah. That's one thing I don't want to hear.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club.
We're joined in the studio now by one of my favourite comedians, Rhys James. I always say in taxis and stuff like that, I always say I'm a writer.
Yeah, me too. Have I told you this story before?
No.
The time I got in a taxi, and I always used to do that writer because you don't want to have the conversation with the taxi driver about being a comedian.
But the follow-up question is just you can't get out of, which is, what do you write?
Yeah, yeah.
I write sitcoms.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So I was in this taxi. He goes, what sort of stuff do you write? And I went, comedy. I thought, oh, fuck, mate.
Yeah,
and then he went, oh, what type of comedy do you write? And I said, satire. And then the taxi driver said, you know what they say? Satire is the lowest form of wit.
Joey Page.
Jim Sturgis joins us in the studio. Do you find when you've been, like, it's obviously rehearsals and filming and that takes a real long time. Do you sometimes find the traits of these characters seeping into your life?
There was a film I did called London Fields where I was covered in tattoos. I was playing like a really unpleasant character in that film, and it started to rub off on me, and I was sort of walking around thinking I was probably a lot harder than I am in real life, and someone nearly ran me over in a car, and I was a little too quick to fucking offer him out.
I come out of this studio on a Wednesday going, I'm well good at this, and then it's like, I might get out of my way, I'm getting on the bus.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Politics Matters with Eleanor Penny, general election coverage on FUBAR Radio.
There is a danger, if you like, in trying to fight the last wars on these things. Immigration was a massive political issue 3 or 4 years ago. My own view is that we spent far too much time talking about the numbers of people coming in and out of country and not enough, for example, on integration, which Louise has done a lot of work on. Let's, you know, the austerity argument. I can understand why Labour wants to return to the 2017 debate, but hang on just a minute.
We need to talk about your record on austerity, which you look as if you're going to continue.
Hang on just a minute. But the point is, I think everybody, we're beyond austerity now.
We are not beyond austerity. That is a disgraceful thing to say.
Hang on just a minute.
I do have to interrupt here because I know what you want to say about some of these other issues from a philosophical point of view. But on austerity, you are trying to distance what the party did in terms of austerity. If I could finish my sentence,
in fairness, I would actually be able to explain what I was trying to say, which is, look, all of the parties, in terms of their offer at the moment, are in a completely different fiscal position. They are not proposing to, you know, halve the deficit.
Welcome back. What you've just heard is our dear Chaka Amana on the idea that we're just beyond austerity. 120,000 people dead. A lot of fraff. 800,000 more kids in poverty than in 2010 when the Conservatives took power. What? Sorry, wasn't listening. So, to unpack where we actually are and this wonderful thing that we like to call political and economic reality, I have with me in the studio James Medway and Alfie Sterling. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
Not too bad on the whole.
Considering the fact that we are 24 days from what could be socialism or what could be barbarism.
Well, sort of coin toss, isn't it, at this point?
The adrenaline is pumping in either option. So what we're going to be talking about here is essentially, is austerity over, as a lot of people have been talking about? We're going to be getting more into the weeds of Labour's economic policy and talking about things like who really is a wealth creator and what does nationalisation and how do I? So, James.
Yes.
How would you, I guess, characterise the state that we're in? Because we hear a lot of talk about the fact that, actually, you know, loads more people are employed than they were 5 years ago. And, you know, we have growth. It's not much, but it's there. So what do you think of what Chaka was saying? Are we beyond austerity? Is everything looking up?
No, of course not. No. We're in a dire place. We've been in a dire place for a long period of time and dire for most people. The decline in most people's living standards is the worst since the Industrial Revolution. The people are paid less today in real terms after you take account of inflation than they were in 2008. I mean, this is sort of unprecedented for generations. There hasn't been this kind of decline. If you then throw in the obvious impacts of austerity, I mean, you can see it just walking here, the amount of homelessness that there is in somewhere like London and all the big cities. You can see this kind of decay in front of us. So the idea that you can point at a sort of magic number and say, oh, well, growth is still just about there. By the way, currently the weakest since, what, 2010 or thereabouts. Or you can say...
A coincidence, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, totally. Or you can point to... You can point at something like wages are picking up a bit. Actually, that's flattened off a bit now. Or you can point to employment and say, oh, well, there's loads and loads of people in work. Well, yeah, sure, but the quality of jobs that are being created. Zero-hour contracts are picking up again. They're almost back to the record levels we saw, which is sort of 900,000. Loads of people in insecure work of various different sorts. The TUC count, I think, is about 5 million or thereabouts in insecure work of various kinds. So this is just a woeful situation to get yourself into, and it's not good enough for Chuck or anybody else to say, oh, well, this is all water under the bridge now. It's all broad sunny uplands from here on in.
So what do we mean when we say, you know, austerity is over? Because that seems to sort of hit different emotional buttons, shall we say, depending on who we're talking to. And in fairness, the Conservative Party are promising what they didn't really promise back, you know, in the far off lost times of just over 2 years ago, back in 2017 election. They're promising much more money for the NHS, promising money for education, that kind of thing. So is austerity over?
I mean, I think part of the problem here, and I agree with kind of everything James just said, really, in terms of, you know, just visibly the things you can see and the damage that austerity's caused. But I think that, you know, you've almost got to try and find a definition of austerity, desperately find one, which might succeed in saying it's ended. And it basically doesn't exist. So, you know, there's the effects of austerity, there's the homelessness, there's people relying on social care that now isn't funded, local transport, you know, almost every interaction we have with different kind of public goods has been hit. But actually, you know, the big problem here is that Tories, as you say, are saying austerity is over, we're increasing spending. But if you look at the numbers, they reversed about a third of the amount of spending that they cut back since 2010. And that's the most generous measure possible. So that's just kind of total money spent. They've now reversed about a third of it. But actually, if you look at the share of government spending, either per person, because obviously the population's got bigger, we need to spend more money because there are more people that need services, need social care, need childcare. We've actually only reversed about 10, 12%. And at the current trajectory, it would take the Tories 10 years to get back to where we were in 2010. So it's very hard to find a measure where austerity is over.
And because we're not, happily, we're not constrained by PERDA rules on FUBAR Radio, I can say that I hope they don't get 10 years to do it. So when we look at Labour's manifesto, right, big splashy headline figures, £150 billion for schools, £250 billion investment in what they call a green industrial revolution. Yep. A lot of people are saying, OK, it's great, I like it, more stuff, everyone likes more stuff, but how in the hell are we going to pay for it?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is a great chunk. I mean, the figures you just quoted, $150 billion for schools and hospitals and for the extraordinary damage done to the kind of fabric of public services in this country over the last few years through a lack of investment. I mean, it stacks up quite rapidly. I mean, the number of sort of repairs now required in hospitals just to fix things like broken, you know, cracks in the roof and in one case leaky sewage pipes and this sort of thing, quite unpleasant, particularly in a hospital, is £6 billion. I mean, that's the kind of damage that austerity and cuts to over a period of time. So you have to spend a lot of money repairing that. If you want to pay for this sort of thing, what can happen and what is happening at the minute, and it's been the case for the last 10 years, is that the cost for government to borrow is so low, it's below the rate of inflation. So in practice, once you take the real cost of borrowing, government borrowing, in fact, is the cost of it is negative, so it has a negative interest rate. In other words, it's almost like people who want to lend the government money are prepared to take an interest rate so low, it's below the rate of inflation, that they're practically paying the money, the government money to borrow, which is quite a peculiar situation, but this is the post-2008, post-crash world we live in, that it's possible for governments to go out and spend these sorts of figures because the cost of them doing it is so very, very low.
What you're kind of hinting towards is essentially a very subtle ideological shift in the way we talk about politics, but is unrecognisable from how we talked about it back in 2008, 2009, 2010, when the coalition government between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives first got into power, because austerity, aka massive cutbacks to the public sector, the packaged along with things like a transfer of public wealth into private hands, a decimation of workers' rights, so bosses can essentially suppress wages and that will somehow transfer into increased profits and that will benefit people in a very unexplained, vague, hand-wavy way. That seems to have kind of, that consensus seems to have kind of crumbled, which is a story that a lot of people maybe aren't talking about. So how did we get here? Like, how did we have this massive political sea change in which people are sort of seem to be, apart from the Lib Dems who've committed to austerity indefinitely, people seem to be universally embarrassed by what happened in 2010, 2011.
Yeah. Well, I think it partly relates to almost relates to like another answer to your question before about how do you pay for this, because what we've got to remember is the last 10 years are pretty exceptional. They're not the norm. They're not the norm in our own history, and they're not the norm internationally either. So at some point, there was only so long that kind of spin in the media and like alternative narratives around why austerity was good could survive. So in some ways, it's almost a surprise we haven't swung back sooner. We're now reverting to a more kind of like normal conversation. And I would just say, you know, it's interesting in a way that, you know, the amount of tension on all the spending and the first kind of couple of weeks of this election campaign, almost all the coverage has been looking at how many billions are different parties spending or not spending. But actually, when you boil it down into kind of just more digestible numbers, in the case of Labour, they're basically saying they want to borrow about 2% of GDP more. That would take us back to an average amount of investment that lots of other North European countries already do. It's what actually the UK did under all different colours of government for about 30 years in recent history. And then on the spending side, we're talking about, you know, an increase of about 3% of GDP, which they would match with tax rises on the richest. And again, that would take us to government spending going up to about 40, 42% of GDP, very similar to most other European countries. So we really are reverting back to a more normal conversation, if you like, and the more radical stuff is what they're going to do beyond just public spending, I'd say.
So why is it so terrifying, basically? Because you do see a lot of spin thrown at even basic kind of Keynesian investments. This is not people calling for the destruction of class, capital and property, more's the pity. It's people getting back to tax levels that are comparable with France, Germany, Italy, actually lagging behind, distinctly, from some European nations. So what is it that's particularly terrifying? Is it just the British condition that we don't like this kind of thing?
There's a large part of that. I mean, it's sometimes striking just how weird Britain's political economy, how weird it is, how we talk about economics and what we expect to be happening here relative to, as Alfie says, what happens to the rest of Europe. You know, there is nothing greatly unusual about having public ownership of your railways, right? This happens right the way across Europe, right the way across the world. There's nothing greatly unusual about having richer people pay a bit more in tax. There's nothing really unusual about government saying we're and spend some money and invest. I mean, at the heart of sort of Britain's immediate economic problem, why is it that we have so many poorly paid, insecure jobs? Why is it that nothing seems to work quite as it should do, except for a few people at the top, is that we live in a very, very low investment economy. In other words, you have firms that don't spend money and invest in new technologies and create jobs, that good, secure jobs, and you have a government that doesn't invest in infrastructure, railways, transport, hospitals, whatever it might be, not on anything like the scale that you see elsewhere. And that's there, I think, because we've developed over 30, 40 years in particular a kind of rhetoric around economics, which is the government is always bad, so it should always get out of the way, and that tends to work in favour of a few rich people at the top, particularly if you're in finance, frankly.
I would add, though, that I think it's not necessarily true that people are really scared of this stuff. Mm. So, you know, your question is why are people scared? I'm not convinced they are.
It depends which people you're talking about, right? People who are in newspapers.
Yeah, well, exactly. So much of our media tells people to be scared. Mm. A lot of the commentariat tell people to be scared. But if you look at the polling that's been done on this stuff, large majorities do support higher taxes in return for better public services. So I would say actually most people aren't that scared, and they actually welcome this conversation, and they probably welcome the policy as well.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to see like people who have columns in like major newspapers telling on themselves in ways that they have no idea, being like losing their minds over how Labour's policies will absolutely tank the value of your investment portfolio in property in London. And I'm like, who's?
I remember the
ours? Like, who are you talking to here? Who is your audience? I'm just going to get us back to that. I think that brings in really what isn't talked about enough is that how kind of common sense and how intuitive a lot of these so-called like radical policies coming out of Labour and to some extent the Green Party and the SNP are to a lot of people. I just want to bring in one economist here.
I think we should like bring people together. We should make sure we're taking care of everybody. And, you know, we've got a big, wonderful world we live in. And people have a lot of money. And then we have to figure it out, you know, so that it's, you know, the distribution of wealth. Go Labour.
That was Danny DeVito. Thank you, Danny DeVito. I just want to get us back to one of the central sort of bones of contention between Tories on one hand, Labour on the other, or, you know, Labour post-2015, I should say. The reason that on which people justify giving massive subsidies, massive tax cuts, etc., to people who already have a lot of cash to splash, is the idea that they're wealth creators, right? Mm. what is Wealth Creator? How do I wealth create? Like, what are people talking about there?
Well, there's a rhetoric here, which is that wealth creators tend to be people who just have a lot of wealth. So wealth havers might be a more accurate way of talking about it if you're on the Tory side. But I mean, what they use it as is saying, well, if you own a business, if you are fabulously wealthy, then you've created this wealth and therefore you should have it. What it tends to overlook is that in order to create large amounts of wealth, usually, in fact, nearly always, you need to employ a large amount of people who go and do the work that actually creates the wealth. And if you want an honest definition of wealth creation, it's basically people who work, and it's kind of the raw materials and the nature that you can use to make stuff. That's the real wealth. That's where wealth comes from. And if you happen to have an awful lot of it, it's often going to be the case that you personally haven't created that stuff, but you have a claim on what other people have created. So the entire kind of rhetoric around wealth creation, I think, is just kind of an excuse for saying, well, these people at the top, they deserve to have all this wealth, and everybody else is sort of, well, God knows what they're doing. If you go out to work, you know, you're not wealth creating, you're just kind of hanging around, leeching off these generous billionaires who employ you. You know, it's a completely top turvy view of the world.
Yeah, thank you for letting me work 40 hours exactly. a day for you. Like, thank you for letting me be paid under minimum wage. All of this sounds, I mean, you know, very mundane almost when you put it in these kinds of terms. So I want to kind of ask you about the stuff that is more radical, right? The stuff that does go beyond the limits of what we'll call social democracy, aka capitalism, healthy business, with a healthy welfare state to kind of sop up, you know, when capitalism goes wrong, etc. Things like 4-day working week, mm-hmm. things like worker ownership funds, things like universal basic income. I'm wondering what you would want to see in a Labour manifesto, which still hasn't been published, that could push us further, make this a real sort of 21st century manifesto, not just kind of looking back and restoring what we previously had.
Yeah, I mean, I think you gave quite a good list there. I think the shorter working week is a big one. And in some ways it touches on your point around wealth, because I think another point, in addition to what James was saying, is that it's not just a question of who owns wealth and the difference between wealth creator and owner, it's also how you measure it and what do you mean by wealth.
So, I'm sorry, can you just unpack what a worker ownership, what we're talking about by worker ownership here?
Well, I was going to talk about short working week, actually, but the inclusive ownership fund is the idea that that workers would be able to have an ownership stake in the company they work for. So if it's a large company, I think over 250 employees, then that company would be asked to put some of their profit into buying some of their own shares, which they then hand over to workers. But it would be locked and it would remain in the firm. So, you know, as workers come and go, the existing workers would keep a hold of it. And they get to be able to, you know, influence the direction of the company, make decisions on governance, and also, yes, take a return on profits as well through dividends. But I think the shorter working week is also important. And it touches on, in some ways, a more interesting conversation around what is wealth and what is wealth beyond just monetized wealth. So it's not just a question of how much money is there around and who owns it. Things like time is also a form of wealth. That kind of is wealth and power to do what you want to do with your life. And so if you're able to get to a place where we can reduce the amount of time people spend working and don't reduce other means that they have, like money, then you're actually handing over a lot of wealth to people and communities. And that's, I think, quite a radical frontier for this election, if it does come into the manifestos.
That's one of the things that really strikes me about, you know, people in this age demographic that's, you know, endlessly raked over by us here and also by, you know, a lot of the press, right? Talking about millennials as people who have abandoned or have been abandoned by the kind of economic mainstream, right? Mm. And of course, there is a lot of people are suffering through that, right? You know, the vast majority of people I know either, you know, self-unemployed, very low paid freelance contracts which kind of come and go at the whim of someone you've never met before, if you can put a name to them, and people who are kind of use the language of so-called adulting to as a placeholder to indicate the fact that generationally we don't have access to the kinds of signifiers of adulthood that our parents did. Like, we can't afford kids, we can't afford mortgages, we don't have like stable incomes and that kind of thing. So what we're talking about here is that kind of generational gap, which has caused a lot of suffering. But that is a sort of ideological opportunity, or should say an imaginative opportunity here, because we've never really had a buy-in to the stable 9-to-5. That's kind of meaningless. Like, I've had a 9-to-5 job maybe, I think, once for about 4 months. And then I was also working 2 other jobs because it didn't pay enough. And so what do you make of this opportunity here, of this kind of potential like radicalism essentially among young people?
I think what you're describing is a very, very common experience for basically pretty much anyone who entered the labour market, who started work or tried to start work after 2008. You know, particularly if you can see in the figures, if you're a young worker, your wages, your real pay has fallen much more sharply than anybody else. So there's a whole generation of people who've been made fairly systematically worse off, and not just worse off right now, but like you say, it's people's sort of expectations about what might happen in the future, the chances of owning a house, you know, it's not really there. Okay. The possibility of a career that sort of means something, that there's some kind of progression involved, it's not really there for a great swathe of people.
And even that's very kind of like dependent on whether or not you had an expectation of a middle class life in the first place.
I think that's it. What you're talking about here is really the disappearance of a middle class, right? Where once upon a time you had institutions that would generate a large number of people actually quite comfortably off one way or the other. They would have a house, they would have a career, they can expect a pension, these sort of things. Put it all together and you think, that's your middle class. That is crumbling in front of us. That's what it means when you have a whole generation of people who are entering the labour market who don't expect to get any of these things. Now, that's a moment, you'd have thought, of potentially big political instability. That's a point in which people think, well, I don't have an attachment to the system as it is. I do want to see things different. I do want a government that's going to change things in quite a dramatic fashion. And that, I think, is part of what you see, particularly around the Labour Party in the last few years.
I mean, in some ways I say it might be a bit worse than that, actually, because I'm not sure that the middle class is necessarily entirely disintegrating. It's more that people's access to it has changed. So it's still there and it's smaller, but your passport into it is what your parents did and what class your parents were.
Precisely.
So it's, in some ways it's even worse. It's still there. It's just access to it has been hugely restricted.
For final thoughts, I want to wrap up on how this relates to the climate crisis, because all of this is like very well and good. But we are facing the biggest civilizational, political, economic, social, everything you can name, challenges to our system that humanity has ever faced. How did these kinds of policies figure into that, James?
Well, the one that we've been talking about is a sort of massive investment program, the Green New Deal, as it got called in America and has been taken up here, where you say, well, look, we need to completely overhaul how the economy operates, and we need to do it in a way that if we want to decarbonize, reduce the impact of what we do, what the economy does and how it affects the environment, we have to change pretty much everything. Energy systems, you have to insulate houses, you have to get rid of petrol-driven cars, get everybody in public transport. All of this is a big, big effort. So you can create loads and loads of jobs to do this. You can transform how the economy works. You can go to places which have seen no investment, no decent jobs, no prosperity for decades now, some parts of the country like this, and say, actually, we can do something different and better here. And we have to do that because we need to take on climate change.
And I think that, if nothing else has convinced you, will convince you, has a possibility of convincing you, if you are under the age of, 60, in your lifetime, you will potentially face a massive ecological breakdown. But that is not a guarantee. We can do something about it. And that is why you should register to vote, are you silly? Register to vote, and please don't vote for the Conservatives. Please don't vote for anyone who will put the Conservatives in power, because I don't want to spend the last years of my life fighting over the last bottled water. And on that cheery note, I would like to thank my guests, Alfie Sterling and James Medway.
Thank
and
you.
Of course, we had the delightful Dahlia Gabriel and Molly Scott-Cato with us in the studio as well. We're gearing up for the leadership debates tonight, and I, for one, hope that Corbyn banishes the Bullingdon horror back to the swamp pit he crawled out of. As the old proverb goes, here we fucking go. Join us again next week on FUBAR Radio, where we will be raking through the mud of this election and demystifying the jargon to bring you more news and views and all of that good stuff. Thank you for joining us. I've been your host, Eleanor Penny. Have a great day.